Okay. Well, thank you, Natasha, for the invitation. It's great to be back in Santa Barbara. I learned physics in Santa Barbara. That's a simple way to put it. So I'm going to be talking, I think, two-thirds about, I've totally restructured my talk in the last 24 hours, which is, I guess it's the, you know, it's the blessing and the curse of having a laptop. And but I'm trying to maybe adapt it to what I'm perceiving or projecting to be the, you know, the interests here at the ITP. So the first two-thirds of the talk, roughly, will be about an idea, basically it's an idea talk, of a way of implementing the elements or meeting, satisfying the requirements for quantum information processing and maybe quantum computing. And then the second part, I will talk briefly about one particular theoretical topic and show you the result. So, but it's relevant. So hopefully there will be a connection between the two. So what I'm going to do is first begin by talking about the requirements for quantum computation, in particular as been outlined by David DiVincenzo, sort of five commandments. I think there used to be 10, but he dropped five, and so now there are only five. It's an old Mel Brooks joke. Anyway. So then I'm basically going to give you one example of that. I'm going to summarize what we're doing and how we are going to meet those requirements, and then tell you about the physical systems that we will be using, which are really are the basis of everything, and then tell you about how we might do perform some initial experiments to see whether those requirements can be met. And then at the end, I'll talk about a way of making the task of the experimentalist easier, kind of a risk architecture for quantum computers. That's not what I'm going to be talking about, but rather a rather simple way of doing this with two spins being used to represent a quantum bit. Okay, so let me begin by telling you the approach that we are taking really from a real point of view. So here we are, we got suckered into this, and we're going to try and see if we can make the elements of a scalable quantum computer. So it really begins with materials. And so what we have is a center for oxide semiconductor materials for quantum computation. So sort of from an experimental point of view, we have to begin with the materials. And this is going to be done with Joachim Ohner and Rodney McKee, Daryl Schlom, and John Yates. And then once we have some materials that we think are interesting, David Auschlom, Bruce Kane, and I will be performing some experiments. And then at the same time, we'll have support from the theoretical end, from Michael Flatte, Steve Helberg, Daniel Loss. And so basically, let me say, in my own group, I have one right now, a postdoc and a graduate student and some undergraduates working on this project, which has really just begun in the last few months. So David DiVincenzo, in a great service to experimentalists, materials people who would like to try their hand at making a quantum computer, has listed a very clear set of requirements that are necessary to do quantum computation. I was checking the IBM webpage, and I saw that actually IBM is now offering a quantum computer. It's true. But the problem is that they don't have all the parts, so it actually the memory is all out of stock in the memory. And they also, the CPU is backordered, and there are no keyboards that fit. They don't have the right sockets. And of course, there are also some problems with the whole system. It's kind of noisy, and that's kind of messing things up. Okay, well, so let me put that into words, his words, actually. So it's a set of five requirements where, that you would need for a scalable quantum computer, so not just a quantum computer with one qubit or two. And so the first is that, of course, it has to be scalable, by definition. And then the quantum bits or qubits have to be well characterized. So there has to be a clear two-level system that you can identify as your quantum bit. And then the second requirement is you can think of it as being the input. You need to be able to initialize or boot the quantum computer or put the system into a well-defined state. And then the third one is really one, I think, that separates a lot of different proposals. And it says that the time for decoherence in the system has to be much longer than the time it takes to perform a gate operation. So according to the theory of fault-tolerant quantum computation, it's about 4 or 5 orders of magnitude. That's hard to find. And your system has to be, in order to be a universal quantum computer, you have to have a certain minimum set of gate operations. And it's well known how minimal that gate set is. And in the end, once you have done all this computation, you need to perform a measurement with high quantum efficiency. Okay, so now I'm going to give you the one example, which is what we're trying to do, and it's going to be just a summary, and then I'm going to go into more detail into the various ways in which we are addressing all of these issues. So the scalable system are going to be formed from the spin 1/2 electrons in semiconductors, in particular in silicon, and with this small amounts of germanium, and I'll explain what the germanium is doing later. Well, right now, in fact, the germanium, the only purpose really of the germanium is to provide a window into silicon to allow us to use light to initialize the spin orientation of the electrons. So if we could just do it in silicon, we would, but we can't. So now the third requirement, having to do with the separation of time scales, I believe a silicon is a very good choice, and I really sort of learned this from reading Bruce Kane's Nature paper, where he was interested in using nuclear spins. But if you the spin lifetimes in silicon are quite long, and the gates, which I will tell you about, the way in which we plan to make the gates, are going to be quite short. So I think we are going to have a rather large, at least in theory, a large separation of time scales. And so it should be possible to perform the 1 and 2 qubit operations, although we will be focusing on the 2 qubit operations for reasons which I'll tell you about later. And in the end, we would like to be able to perform measurements with high quantum efficiency, and I'll tell you briefly about another proposal from Bruce Kane, which is a way of converting spin information into charge information that seems very promising. Okay, so let me begin with this with the basic architecture. And don't worry if you okay. FE stands for ferroelectric, and I will explain what a ferroelectric is later. So here it's really sort of a top-down outline of what is going on. We have a set of localized states for single electrons that are arranged on a linear array, and the separation between them is on the order of the optical wavelength. Now, there are going to be wires or channels that will allow these electrons to travel and couple between them, between nearest neighbors. And so the way in which you, one of the universal gate operations is a controlled knot, and it's a combination of having a square root of swap operations and single qubit or single spin rotations And so the idea is, if you had wanted to do a controlled knot between qubit 2 and 7, first thing you do is you bring them together by performing quantum swap operation, just swap them until they're nearest neighbor, and then you perform your nearest neighbor controlled knot, which is a square root of swap and then a rotation on one of the qubits and then another square root of swap, and then you can bring them back. So again, this is sort of a very simple illustration of how just having nearest neighbor interactions is sufficient, because you can build up longer range interactions. Okay.
What distances do you have between
lines? Well, they're on the order of a wavelength, so maybe a micron or so, which is large compared to the extent of the electron wave function. Okay. And these interactions are going to be, they're qualitatively shown here as two different types. But it turns out that you only need one. You only need the exchange interaction. I will tell you about that in the latter part of the talk, of this talk. Okay. So let me now talk about electron spins. Spin 1/2 is a natural two-level system, and it's quantum mechanical, so it forms a very natural quantum bit. If you think about sort of electronics as we know it today, and you were worried about the electron wave function, it's typically in undergraduate textbooks written as some spatial part times a two-dimensional vector, which represents the spin. And oftentimes that part is just thrown out. In recent years, the emphasis has changed somewhat, and so now the spin degree of freedom is getting first billing. So instead of thinking about an electron as a charge with a spin attached, you now can refer to an electron as a spin with a charge attached. Okay, and a term has been coined, spintronics, to reflect that. I should say that you don't really want to ignore the spatial part of the wave function. In fact, it plays a very important role, because it's what allows you to have interactions between the spins. It forms the basis of the Heisenberg exchange interaction in particular. Okay, well, why so much interest in this? That really was triggered by a slew of experimental results in the last few years in David's group, where in the compound semiconductor gallium arsenide, electron spins were shown to have quite long coherence times on the order of 100 nanoseconds. And in a series of experiments, it was found that there was, you could kick them and beat them and do all sorts of things, send them across interfaces, and they still were very good at maintaining the space information or coherence. Now, yeah?
If you're going to use Johnstadt's, the previous page, where you write the electron wave function as a spatial times a spin, how do you justify not including entanglement between the degrees, between the spin?
Well, the justification is that the interaction between them, which is spin orbit, is weak, and it's very weak in silicon. And it's about three orders of magnitude weaker than in gallium arsenide. So that sort of explains why if you multiply this by 10 to the 3, you get roughly the T2 times for silicon. Okay, well, so from a theoretical point of view, the idea of using quantum dots and electrons spins was pursued by Daniel Loss, David DiVincenzo, and others. And I referred earlier to the work of Bruce Kane, which was very important in bringing attention, I think, to silicon as a potential candidate. The problem with silicon compared to, say, gallium arsenide is that the optical techniques that have been so successfully used in David Auchinleck's group cannot be applied to silicon, because silicon is an indirect band semiconductor. And so the goal, and one of our goals, is to try and open up a window into silicon using very small germanium islands, and these islands will have direct or quasi-direct optical transitions, provided that they are sufficiently small. And one way of doing this is by nucleating their formation through small amounts of carbon. And so here you can see actually an STM image showing these very tiny islands that were formed. And in fact, the islands for the right deposition conditions, growth conditions, the islands will only form where the carbon is present. And that suggests that it may be possible to place these quantum dots with a precision if you can put down the carbon in the right place. People who use SEMs and other electron microscopes know very well that if you just leave the electron in one spot, there's a tiny formation of carbon that happens. And so this suggests one approach. There are other approaches as well. So here you can see the very bright luminescence coming from germanium islands. And the comparison in black, the curve shows that the brightest silicon germanium superlattices that one can grow with the shortest period. And so they're quite bright, and this is a very encouraging sign. So how do you make these? Well, I suggested one way, using an electron beam and perhaps using creating carbon nucleation sites. But there are many other approaches, and this schematic that I'm showing you here actually is a very versatile, it's called a nano workbench, and it's ultra high vacuum. It has four scanning tunneling microscopes that can all access the same nanostructure. You can see what's going on with the E-beam, so in the SEM mode, and you can do Auger to get chemical information. And so when I saw this, I thought, well, this is a great way to do nano MBE, molecular beam epitaxy. So this is just a picture showing two of the four tips in action. So they didn't have all four working, so they put a mirror. And but actually now, if you put a mirror, then you'd see eight. So they actually have made, it's a very ambitious project. You can make a number of structures using the electric field from an STM, for example. Here you can see a circular array. It's been stretched out. You can see it's only 0.8 nanometers high.
Can you explain how the carbon gets there?
Well, there are a number of ways. It's actually very, there are a myriad of processes by which a carbon can bind to the surface. Maybe we can talk about it afterwards.
But those are carbon?
No, this is not carbon. These are copper clusters on gold. So they're just showing you some other things that they've done in the past. This is a germanium quantum dot that was grown on the surface of silicon. By cracking a digermane molecules in the electric field of the STM tip. And so you would then anneal this structure. But the problem is that without carbon, annealing will actually allow for interdiffusion between the germanium and silicon and probably won't have the optical property. So we're pretty sure that we need to have the carbon present. All right. So now we have these electrons localized near the quantum dots, and how are we going to do this coupling? This is the gate. Before I can tell you that, I have to tell you what I mean by a ferroelectric. And I'm sure that you're much more familiar with magnetism, but it's quite analogous. It's basically a spontaneous electric polarization. So you have these dipole moments that are that spontaneously form in the crystal, and they align below some critical temperature. So it's very much like a ferromagnet. So you can use, instead of a magnetic field, you can use an electric field to reverse these ferroelectric domains. And one of the differences, though, is that the domain walls are actually quite much smaller than for ferromagnetic domains, because the physical basis for ferroelectricity is very different. So to give you an idea of what happens, if you take a structure like barium titanate, a perovskite, it has a center of symmetry, and because of that, there is no way for polarization to develop in any particular direction because it would have to be equal to the minus of itself. But if you have a symmetry breaking, for example, going from cubic to tetragonal, now it is possible for the positively charged titanium to move off center and develop an internal polarization in the unit cell. And then you can imagine that there will be couplings, which would lead to long-range order. And it's possible to reverse the orientation without, but with an electric field. So this should look very familiar. It's sort of a hysteresis loop, but it's a ferroelectric one. So here I'm plotting the polarization versus electric field. It's really just a schematic. But you can see that at zero electric field, it's possible to have two thermodynamically stable states, one in which the polarization is pointing up, for example, and one in which it's pointing down. And it's possible to make them go up and down and have boundaries with that are very thin. Okay. So this is one of the reasons why these materials are of interest is that, of course, up and down can be thought of as one and zero, a classical one and zero, but you may be able to make photoelectric random access memory, memory chips, and I was involved actually some earlier collaboration with a group that was trying to get that big grant, and it was called CHIPS, and so I was asked to make a figure, and so I wrote a picture of two perhaps well-known characters to those of you who have watched television in the U.S. in the 1970s. So anyway, the point is that you can be creative with this, and you can write anything you want. And in fact, I brought a little demonstration with me. So here it is, a little pocket etch-a-sketch, and you can pass this around if you want. Basically, you can imagine that what you're doing is you're taking a top electrode, which is very small, from, let's say, from a coated AFN tip, and you can drag it across the surface with either a positive or negative potential with respect to the bottom electrode. And so by choosing it to be up or down, you can create polarization that's locally pointing up or pointing down. And as I said, you can make very fine structures. Okay. Well, why is this interesting? It gets interesting when you allow a semiconductor to take part and to be influenced by the ferroelectric. So again, here we have two domains, down and up, and now we place a semiconductor right next to the ferroelectric. Well, the bound charges of the ferroelectric are going to influence the electrons in the semiconductor. In particular, one of the differences between magnetism and ferromagnetism and ferroelectricity is that these are real charges and they can be compensated. So the simpler case is to imagine that you have just you've compensated for all the charges at the top and you're left with the plus and minus charges. Well, the plus charges are going to attract electrons, the minus ones are going to repel them, and as you said, you can make anything you want. So you can make little wires. And the line width is very small. In fact, it's probably smaller than we can measure. But in order to do this, the interface quality is really important. So without that, it's possible for other donor electrons to compensate the other end, and basically now there's no more field effect, and so the electrons are not influenced by the ferroelectric anymore. But fortunately, over the last decade or so, there has been great progress in the area of mating a ferroelectric to a semiconductor, and in this case it's a strontium titanate onto silicon, and it's very difficult to do, but it can be done, and so it turns out that these have enormous ferroelectric field effects. So what you have to remember is that the spontaneous polarization of barium titanate is about 10 to the 14 per square centimeter. That's huge, okay? But it's not 10 to the 14, it's plus or minus 10 to the 14, with the plus or minus being something that you can control. And so actually, I did take a structure which was barium titanate on germanium, and those are very well lattice matched. And I wrote, my student, our group, we wrote structures that you can see here. And the noise here is it reflects the fact that it's quite difficult to actually measure the ferroelectric response because for a number of reasons. So the idea is then that you can make nanostructures in this way. Okay, so there's a second property of the ferroelectrics, which I'd like to tell you about. It's not as well known, and that is the nonlinear optical properties of these materials. Well, it's probably known among experimentalists that you can take Chi2 or a material that has a second order polarizability and do frequency doubling. But that's where you have omega 1 plus omega 2 from 2, or omega going to 2 omega. But you can also get rectification, which is the omega minus omega. And that is something that can be used in these structures. So the way to think about it is that when you shine light on a structure, such as the one I'm showing here, the magnitude of the ferroelectric polarization is reduced. Okay, so if it's going up or down, it will change in magnitude, not all in the same direction. If it did that, it would be boring. But you can see that, in fact, in this situation, you can have, for example, a double well with a barrier, a tunneling barrier, and one electron here, one electron here. And now you turn on the light, and for a brief moment, the barrier is reduced, okay? And the idea is to use this effect to make a controllable Heisenberg exchange gate. And it can be done quite rapidly, as rapidly as the time it takes to turn on and off your light, which is about 10,000 gigahertz. Yeah?
Do you address the barriers individually, or do you raise and lower them all for the whole chip?
Well, what you can do is you can raise and lower them all within the spot size, which is on the order of a micron. But what you have to realize is that the terahertz polarization that's coming from this modulation of the ferroelectric polarization has a sign which varies rapidly in space. So you're mixing the essentially plane wave light with a local polarization to produce a terahertz polarization that is itself modulated in space on length scales that are relevant for the electron wave function.
What is the index of this material?
The index, well, it's you can think of it as a very wide band gap semiconductor. And so this is all non-resonant process. Uh-huh. And it's very strong.
So this switching time is determined by the length of your...
Yeah, there's very little dispersion that you have to worry about. But it's very strong, and if you put in reasonable numbers, you get something on the order of 10 to the 11 per square centimeter. And so this is nothing to sneeze at. So you're using 10 milliwatts, focusing it down to a micron. Okay. So there are some other effects having to do with these displacement currents, and they produce magnetic fields that at their peak can be as large as about 40 Gauss in the structure that I've illustrated here, where you have a circular disk of radius half micron, I believe, and then another one here. At the interface between the two, the magnetic field will sort of have a profile is the derivative of the intensity profile of the laser. And of course, it would cancel out because it's positive and then negative. So it really doesn't have a net effect unless perhaps there was some way to use this in combination with some other interaction to produce a geometrical phase shift. Okay, so here, again, to further illustrate some of the ideas, we take a static ferroelectric polarization, and then we sweep an optical pulse across it. And then when doing so, you can basically create a time-dependent potential that moves along this wire. This is not as crazy as it looks. In fact, very similar types of experiments have already been done using not the ferroelectric polarization, but rather surface acoustic waves. And so electrons can ride, can surf along the surface acoustic waves. Okay, so now I get to a point where we're talking very explicitly about the exchange gate. And here, what I want to show you, it looks like a real calculation. It's not. Okay, it's just a moving schematic. And the idea is that you have two localized states here and here, and you have one electron in each, and then by using the spatially and temporally dependent non-resonant optical pulses, you can use this ferroelectric optical rectification and change the potential and get the electrons and their spins to interact. Well, this is the Schrodinger equation, but there's no dynamics. It's just looking at the two lowest energy states of a single particle, Hamiltonian. And so, anyway, I think you get the picture. It was very useful for me to make this because it's sort of a concrete thing to talk about. And in fact, when I talked with Daniel Loss about this, he immediately thought of two very important things, which I'd like to tell you about briefly. One is that when this gate is occurring, if you don't know what orbital state you're in, you may or may not have to worry about the Pauli exclusion principle. And if you do, then you get an exchange interaction. If you don't, you don't. So that's a problem, because if you're in an incoherent superposition of orbital states, it will result in an incoherent superposition of exchange interactions, and the gate will introduce decoherence. So this is a very important problem that you have to think about. But he was able to come up with a scheme that could minimize this. And so I participated in this. I made the figure, I'm very proud to say. And so the idea is that you have these two wires, which he, as every good theorist should do, approximated by some big quantum dot that has a large number of single particle energy states, and then there's a Coulomb gap. And then in the middle, there's a small quantum dot, which only has one state. So now you can be in any one of these states over here, any one of these states over here, and there's going to be a virtual hop onto this. And the correlations that come from that give you an effective exchange constant that goes as the fourth power of the hopping integral from the wire to the dot. So this was very helpful. The second thing, which I won't talk about too much, has to do with the conditions, the adiabatic conditions for the exchange interaction, whether they need to be satisfied, and under what conditions.
But how strongly you will hop might depend on which state you were in to begin with.
That's true, but basically, because these energy levels are very closely spaced, it shouldn't matter too much, because they're all you're assuming they say extended states. Yeah.
So, as I understand it, you're talking about you've got two electrons that are separate places, and then you bring them together and they undergo an interaction, which is this Heisenberg exchange interaction.
Mm-hmm.
What exactly is the interaction?
Well, it's the normal interaction that comes from having to satisfy the Pauli exclusion principle.
So they're not interacting electromagnetically, just...
Well, sure, though you have to have a Coulomb interaction that gives you a splitting between the singlet and the triplet state.
Okay. And this, I don't feel like I understand what interaction is actually going on here. You put in two electrons in two states, and what do you get out? What's the effect?
Oh, well, the effect is basically, the Hamiltonian JS1.S2. So that's the interaction.
So you're only considering the interaction between the spin degrees of freedom.
Yes, the orbital part only plays a role in that it's the thing that we're coupling to in some sense a classical fashion, because we're using classical fields to control things. Okay, so now we've got this thing, and let's suppose that we do have this Heisenberg gate, and now we want to scale up, we want to have, 10, 50 of them, whatever. How are we going to do this? This is sort of the programming issue and scaling. So what I was suggesting is that you're going to be using femtosecond optical pulses that are going to be whose spacing and timing is going to be controlled with very high precision. So the spacing, okay, it's diffraction limited, but the timing, saying, okay, at t equals zero, I want two spots over here, and then maybe a few hundred femtoseconds later, I want two over here, et cetera. You do this over time, then you get your gate operation. It sounds like science fiction, but it's not. In fact, the technology, the optical technology for doing this exists and was pioneered by Keith Nelson at MIT, and I can talk in detail if anybody's interested about how this works to the best of my abilities after the talk. But the idea is that you can convert a single femtosecond pulse that's going only in one direction to a sequence of pulses that are precisely located in their position and in their timing on a femtosecond level. So this is actually data that was taken from his one of his papers. So at minus 450 femtoseconds, you have these three, you can imagine there's keys on a keyboard that are being played, and then you go like this, and you play them all at once, and then you play one chord, another chord, another chord, but the tempo is quite high. This is about 400 femtoseconds between the presses of the keys. So it is possible, this part at least, it seems feasible up to the order of a few hundred of these quantum bits. Okay, in the end, let's suppose that worked. You need to do the readout. And there are two approaches. One is an optical approach, this is the Faraday or Kerr rotation techniques that are very effective in producing high quality papers. but in fact, they probably won't work for producing a high fidelity readout. And the reason is that they just have a very low quantum efficiency. But they're very versatile and fast. So these are the tools we'd like to use to see whether the things work, but not necessarily the way in which we're going to do the readout. A second approach is a purely electronic one. Now, I said that we're not interested in orbital degrees of freedom, just the spin. But in fact, it is possible to convert spin information into charge information. And Bruce Kane had a very nice proposal for doing this. And imagine you have two electrons and their spins that are occupying a single donor site. Well, there's going to be an energy level splitting between the singlet and the triplet state, but it's going to be long-lived. If you're in one or the other, you'll stay there for a long time because of the low spin-orbit interaction. And so depending on that, you can perform a measurement by trying to ionize one of the electrons. And so you will ionize only the triplet state, but not the singlet state. And so if you can measure that with a single electron transistor, it may be possible to use this as a way of reading out the quantum information. Okay, so I'd like to tell you a little bit about what I'm personally, my own involvement in this approach is. Let's suppose we got the sample and we thought maybe it was going to be interesting and perhaps had potential. We'd need to be able to write ferroelectric nanodomains at low temperature. We need to do the optical excitation in the same area and all of this nonlinear stuff. That's separate. And then you'd have to do some optical detection in the end. So the way in which we're approaching this is we have developed a variable temperature apertureless near field scanning optical microscope, and so this is an instrument that allows us to do the very high resolution AFM patterning of the ferroelectric, and it has optical access as well. Now this is an animation here. But in fact, we, as I said, we have built the thing. It works. And so we're actually in the process of using it to do some preliminary experiments. So I'd be happy to talk with people who are interested. This is where I cut out some things in my talk because I wanted to make room for a brief topic at the end. So let me just summarize this first part. I think we all realize that it's going to be very difficult to make a quantum computer. All of the tasks are very challenging. All of the requirements are very demanding. But that's part of what makes it interesting and exciting and fun. And I think that these ferroelectric semiconductor heterostructures can provide a very powerful tool for accessing the relevant time scales and length scales that you need to manipulate spin interactions in semiconductors. And those that those are very promising for quantum information processing. And I should say that a lot of what I showed you is really has been quite well developed up to a certain point, but it really needs to be taken much further. And that's what we hope to do. Okay, so this is the sort of the end of the what is normally my talk. I did add a brief topic at the end, and I've never given this part before from an audience, so if it's a little rough, I apologize. But I'm going to try to explain what I think is an interesting result. So the title of this mini talk is Universal Quantum Computation with Spin One-Half Pairs, i.e., Electron Spins, and Heisenberg Exchange. So I've got to admit that I'm not so interested in, if I had a quantum computer, I don't think I would be factoring numbers all day long. For me, it's just not the most interesting. There I said it, you know, public venue. I'm actually much more interested in another possible application, which is the simulation of quantum systems. This is not a new idea. I think it goes back to Feynman. A fun way of thinking about this, and I do remember, you know, sort of young age of thinking about this, these kinds of ideas. You think about it, take a quantum system, and you say, well, okay, if you wanted to simulate that system, you know, you couldn't beat that very system at its own game, okay? So any quantum system can simulate its own behavior. It doesn't need a whole bunch of circuits and gates, and it can do it with one gate, okay, and it can do it in real time. Okay, that's pretty great. But of course the gate is just the unitary evolution according to the Hamiltonian of that quantum system. Okay, that's fine. But that's not really a general purpose quantum computer. It's a sort of a dedicated quantum computer. What you would like is have a universal quantum computer that could simulate any system just by tweaking a few things. And of course, the way you do that is you build up these gates and circuits. So if we think about the electron spin as forming a quantum bit, it turns out that you need to have two different kinds of physical interactions to do universal quantum computation. You need to have the single spin rotations, which sort of rotate in an arbitrary direction. And you can think of it as sort of a Zeeman interaction of a local magnetic field. And the other one is spin-spin interactions, and that comes, this is as good as any providing that. And so for now, we'll come back to an experimentalist point of view, that two is a very large number, okay? You know, experimentalists, you start counting, we get very tired, right? Each one takes, a whole rack of equipment, right? So now it's much more expensive, it's more complicated. So you'd like to see if you could get rid of one of them. And so this is a different approach, which is to encode your quantum bit. As a two-dimensional subspace of a larger number of those lower level systems, let's say N of them, and let's give them a name, call them qubits. Okay. So there you have your quantum system. Let's say we were interested, that's what we're really interested in doing, is simulating a quantum system. And so we're going to use, we have come up with an algorithm for doing this, and that involves the use of qubits. But now we have to then take it into the machine level, which involves saying, well, a qubit really is a two-dimensional subspace of three spins, which is the you can think of as a machine language description. What's the advantage of doing that? The advantage is that if you choose the right interaction and you choose the right subspace, then, in fact, it's possible to greatly simplify the physical, the task for the experimentalist. And this was illustrated in a recent paper in Nature, which David DiVincenzo was the lead author, and many other authors there as well. So in that system, they had three spins that were allowed to talk to each other by Heisenberg exchange, and then they could talk nearest neighbors. And it turned out that if you had three or four of these co-gate operations, sort of like the lower level interactions, these Heisenberg things that you turn on and off, that could be used to simulate any single qubit operation. And if you took 19 of these operations, you could simulate a controlled dot. And these two are universal. If you have these two, then you have everything. So, but the nice thing is that you have one, right, which is much less than two. Okay, so, why were there three? Why not two? Well, the answer comes you think about if I had two spins, of course, you'd like to have two is less than three, right? So you'd like to do it with two if you could. The problem is that, I have a Heisenberg exchange that's basically going to, swap or square root or whatever root of swap. It's going to take 0, 1 into 1, 0. And so if we think of the 0 and the 1 as being these two states, the Heisenberg exchange interaction is like a rotation about the x-axis, this qubit x-axis, not the spin x-axis. But the problem is that if you turn on a magnetic field, for example, it doesn't couple to the system because, it's very easy to show. And so you only get rotations about one axis. You need at least two to do universal rotations, and so it's not possible. The system change, the conditions, those restrictions are lifted if you now allow the two spins to reside in different local magnetic environments and you turn on a magnetic field. In that case, the magnetic moments are different, and so the difference of the two, you can think of the 0-1 as sort of anti-aligned spin 1/2, has a magnetic moment which is sort of pointing up and then this one's sort of pointing down. And that couples to a magnetic field. So now you have X. You can now do rotations about the x-axis, and you can also do rotations about the z-axis. In fact, that's always going on. And so now it's possible to do anything. Okay, well, that's nice. But it goes even further than that. The way I like to think about this is that the transformation from this lower level spin, the qubit, to the logical qubit, that transformation turns the Heisenberg interaction into a Zeeman interaction. Okay, and it's very reminiscent of the sort of block spin renormalization group transformations that happen when you sort of you do a renormalization group and you end up with more couplings that weren't there before, or things are sort of changing around. And this is nice because now we have a system where we have an effective spin 1/2 system that you're able to apply a microwave magnetic field using electric fields, real electric fields. Okay, so the electric fields that govern Heisenberg exchange interaction now control this qubit spin resonance. So it's possible to do qubit spin resonance with on a time scale that's four orders of magnitude larger than for regular electron spin resonance, okay? And it just has to do with the fact that you're doing this transformation. So that's nice. In addition, it is possible to link these quantum bits together to produce a controlled knot. And the nice thing is that, in fact, there's no, in contrast to the result that was reported for the three spins, there's no increase in the number of gate operations. Okay, so it's a universal approach, and it's, you know, you can imagine all sorts of things if you were, if you wanted to, of ways of pairing up local magnetic environments. And so that's really all I wanted to say about this, and I think I'll stop here. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? In the proposal involving the ferromagnetic materials to raise and lower the tunneling barrier, I wonder to what degree you have to worry here. Generally, tunneling splittings are exponentially sensitive to the barrier height, at least if I'm, my states are fairly well separated, which from the little schematic it showed me. Mm-hmm. So do you have to worry in this case that you have to precisely control this barrier height with an exponential? You do.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
These are certainly problems that I would really enjoy having to worry about it.
Any other proposal doesn't.
No, you're absolutely correct. I mean, it is very sensitive, but you know, you can think about things that you might be able to do to minimize that.
Germany, it's something which escapes me. I don't see where the germanium quantum dots are there.
Okay, the only reason the germanium quantum dots are there are to allow one to create a spin-polarized electrons in the silicon. So the idea is to create an exciton
in the germanium,
and then okay. Then what happens is the electron pops out because it's a type 2 semiconductor. So it's the conduction band is actually lower in the silicon due to the strain. So for technical reasons, and then the hole is tightly confined into the in the quantum dot.
I have a couple questions. One was, one of the requirements is initialization.
Mm-hmm.
How do you initialize these electrons?
I think I didn't make that very clear. The way that they would be initialized is optically.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's why we have the quantum dots. So the idea is if you take a circularly polarized photon, carries angular momentum, and the idea is to transfer that angular momentum into the spin of the electron, and that can be done. It can be done in gallium arsenide and other direct band semiconductors where you have the appropriate selection rules. Problem is that those selection rules don't exist in silicon, but you could try to engineer them, and that's what we're trying to do.
Well, perhaps I was unclear on this one as well. You were talking about, you know, optically lowering these barriers, that there be a transient, non-uniform magnetic field. Will that not presumably that means it becomes non-uniform one way and then goes the other way.
Yeah.
So won't that wiggle the electrons or holes, as the case may be, back and forth in a spin-dependent way? And won't they spin up, go one way, and spin down, go the other way? Which could potentially be a source of decoherence. I don't know what the numbers work out.
Yeah, I think the problem is that they sort of, whatever they do, they retrace, unless...
Well, if you're wiggling this charge thing back and forth, then you could couple to electromagnetic field.
Yes, actually the combination of the electric field and the magnetic field could, in fact, give you something that doesn't cancel out in the end. That's correct, but for reasons that I didn't talk about.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I have two comments to the first question. Actually, the fact that you have exponential sensitivity can also be a good thing, because you want to be able to switch off your interactions after you have done your gate, and if that's happening with exponential sensitivity, that's good, because you don't want any residual exchange coupling. And the second comment is that I guess the restriction is not that bad, because all you have to care for is that the integral under your interaction over time is a specific number. and you don't care about exact pulse score. So that's still
no, but it's still, if the integral is applied to two numbers, one of which is not so accurate.
Yeah, the question is how does the integral, how robust is it to fluctuations of any kind?
I would say it's quite robust to small fluctuations.
Yeah, if it is, then it's not
exercise. But it's not robust to systematic fluctuations. Okay. So it's maybe a little bit. Yeah.
Sorry. I wanted to ask you about your interaction, you know, how important it is. I know it's important to computation, but can I think about these states as simple particle states or
which states?
These electron distributions.
You mean the orbital states?
I guess it's a question of the density of the electron between the quantum dot.
We only want one in a given place.
Yeah. So, can you
so it's not, well, yeah, I believe so. Because if you create, let's say, one electron hole pair and the electron exits very rapidly, it's left behind this charge, which actually shifts the energy levels a lot, depending on the size of the quantum dot. So actually making them smaller helps you out in this respect as well. So you get you can move yourself out of resonance for a second, for absorption of a second photon.
So how many quantum dots do you need compared to the number of qubits?
Well, depending on how you do it, either
I guess
either a factor of one, two, or three.
I guess you need the quantum dots there to store the holes.
You need them. Actually, you need them to. Well, yes, and to give birth to the electrons.
I mean, because if you only needed them to give birth to the electrons, I guess you could sort of use one quantum dot to.
Yeah, maybe.
Because you're going to move these electrons around all over the place after they
left the quantum dot. That's possible too. But it seems more complicated.
Yeah.
But it's certainly possible. I mean, if we can do these things like sweeping them around, you know, then yeah. That would be.
So, Jeremy, just so I'm trying to understand the structure in that picture where you have the gate, could you show where the dots are then?
Can you give me the number?
22.
This one?
Yeah. That was my question.
What was the question?
So you had the beautiful movie there running, right?
Oh, that movie.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, but it's
this thing.
Right. That's the gate. So where are your dots?
Well, I haven't shown them here. All I did was assume that you had some localized state here and a localized state here.
So that's where your dots are.
It doesn't have to be. Well, if you want to call them a dot, that's fine. Yeah.
But that's not the germanium dots.
No, this is all actually what I did in this is I allowed myself to change the width of the wire as I moved my the Etch-a-Sketch along. I was changing the width of the wire and you get confinement.
But confinement is due to the holes in the germanium quantum dot, or is it due to
this? No, here it's just due to the ferroelectric. But it's, you know, it's a... It's really only for schematic purposes. I just wanted to make it simpler and just have a...
In reality, you envision it to be due to holes trapped in germanium, or...?
Yeah. But it's also, you have to remember, it's a three-dimensional structure, so you have the degree of freedom as well. So the electrons don't really need to be anywhere near the quantum dot. So the quantum could be, you know, could be 50 angstroms below.
So when you do the gate, you expect the electrons to go away from your germanium dots, right?
That's right. Okay. Yeah, so you don't want them to be strongly bound to the quantum dot. I should say one thing, that you think about, there's a technique called modulation doping, which you place donors away from a quantum well and then they can fall in. One of the problems is that, you know, once they fall in, the individual positive charges that are there have the ability, they have local fluctuations, which can at low enough densities can really influence the behavior in the quantum one. Here, the polarization that you make in principle should be much smoother because it's not coming from impurities, it's coming from the ferroelectric. Anyway.
I'm trying to understand how crucial is the ferroelectricity if you were to be able to make nanowires of Chi2 material. Can mm-hmm. you do the same type of operations?
Well, if you didn't have... So you're saying you had the dynamic effect but not the static effect?
Yes. It's not clear to me how important the static effect is to you.
Well, the static effect is important because you want... If you want to, say, bring these electrons together, you don't want them to wander off.
You want to bring them, and of course there should be some trapping, but that, for example, can be done by the hole that is left behind.
Or it can be done electrostatically.
Okay.
Let me rephrase an earlier question I'm still concerned about. When you bring these two electrons in widely separated areas, then you bring them together, so they've got wave packets or something, and they overlap. And they interact through a spin-spin coupling.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if those wave packets overlap by, say, half, then there's no way that I see to avoid entanglement between spin and orbital degrees of freedom at that point, because the spin degree of freedom only acts on the portion of the wave packet that overlaps. So it seems like unless you manage to get your wave packets to overlap perfectly, that ansatz of looking at the state of the electron as a product state of spin and orbital is invalid. And I think that people working with Ivan's group have been doing things with atoms entangling those degrees of freedom, so that seems to be possible.
That's
a different scenario. Okay.
Yeah.
And I don't know what effect that'll have on your quantum computation, but to ignore it seems dangerous.
Well, I have to think whether that's the right way to characterize that interaction as being a spin-orbit interaction.
Isn't there an effective interaction that arises due to the Pauli?
Yeah, and the Coulomb interaction. So the Heisenberg exchange comes from Pauli exclusion and the Coulomb interaction.
You're adiabatically connecting. If you just imagine, just think about, helium. And you think about the ground state of helium, that's the splitting. But you're imagining that you're able to tweak the distance between the electrons in the ground state of helium. And so the single triplet splitting is what you're using to make the gate in that case.
Yeah.
One orbital state that you care about.
Yeah, there are, as I said, there are issues that relate to decoherence during this, during the gate operation. I agree.
I think this is a matter of adiabaticity. So you're not supposed to switch on and off or to bring your dots together faster than 1/h-bar over the energy spin of a single dot.
That's right.
And that's
okay.
This means that the dot is coherent inside itself on a time scale, which is h-bar over this. That's really interesting.
Okay.
What's the distance between the two dots and two sources?
So I need to be able to access them both optically, so wavelength. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.